Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Technology gives kids access to a universe of ideas and information. That is the power of technology. But that unfettered access also means kids at ever younger ages are seeing things you may not want them to see, namely pornography, explicit and sometimes violent. And I'm going to put the warning right here for folks. We won't be talking in unnecessary detail about the content of that porn. But still, this hour may not be appropriate for everyone. But we do hope that parents, caregivers, and adults who can listen do, because there are some big questions here. What does it mean when a child's first introduction to human intimacy, sexuality, and consent come through pornography on their phones? What impact does it have? Can a fourth grader have the mental maturity and social vocabulary to understand a world saturated in adult content? This hour on Point, the call to teach grown-ups how to teach kids about sex and pornography. And you can join us. Parents, have you opened your child's phone and found videos that made your heart sink? How did you or how do you talk to your kids about it? And are you or, and other parents that you talk to, are you worried about porn on your children's phones? Or do you think the kids will be all right? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me today in the studio is Gail Dines, Professor Emerita of Sociology and Women's Studies at Wheelock College in Boston, Massachusetts. She's also author of Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. She's president of Culture Reframed. It's a nonprofit that provides training to educators, teachers, and parents about navigating sexuality and the media. And Culture Reframed released a video yesterday on Father's Day, mind you, called Parent Up, Talk to Your Son About Porn. And we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Gail Dines, welcome to On Point.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So first of all, I just want to play a little bit of this video that your group released yesterday. Again, it's called Parent Up, Talk to Your Son About Porn. It's a short animated film, and it stresses the importance of fathers having conversations with their sons. And in this clip from the film, a boy ponders his relationships with his phone and with the women in his life, and the father ponders about having the talk.
Women are our mothers, sisters, our friends, and lifelong companions. I wish I had that conversation with my father, but I had it with my phone.
Alone.
Alone.
Alone. Alone.
I am my son's father, and I'm going to have that conversation.
An excerpt there from the video Parent Up, Talk to Your Son About Porn. So Gail Dines, what is it about the world that young people live in now that made you and the Culture Reframed feel compelled to release this video yesterday?
Well, I think because pornography is such a public health crisis, and I think before that you have to say stealth public health crisis, which is what really got a lot of us doctors, adolescent psychologists, neuroscientists to figure out how are we going to deal with this, the pornography that is coming at our kids. And by the way, this is not your father's Playboy we're talking about. The pornography that the kids now have access to free is violent, abusive. You go onto Pornhub and studies show that over 90% of the most watched videos have sexual, physical and emotional violence against the women. So if you're thinking of a woman with no clothes on, smiling in a cornfield, with a, forget it. That's the Playboy of yesterday.
Yeah, so we are going to focus this hour about children having access to those videos. But you just started by saying pornography is a public health crisis.
Yes.
I mean, that's quite a broad statement. Do you mean public health crisis writ large for all adults or
children?
Or children. Okay.
Children. Well, first, well, actually, in statistics and research is showing for very many adult men as well. But let's stick to children for the time being. So we know studies are showing that by the age of 16, well over 80% of boys in the Western world have used pornography more than once a week. And what they're catapulted into is a world of sexual violence. When they put porn into Google or whatever they put in, they think they're going to see, you know, maybe women's bodies. They have no idea that they're going to be catapulted into this world of sexual violence. So just let's get inside the head of a 12-year-old, which is about the average age they first look at porn. And he, well, think what he feels like. He's watching cruelty. He's watching a woman be debased. He's watching a woman being hurt. And yet he's aroused. So he thinks he wants this. He had no understanding that this is what he was going to get. And the pornographers are very smart because they say things like, are you man enough to watch this? What 12-year-old boy is going to say, no, I'm not man enough to watch this. I wasn't expecting this. So here is some boy who's never probably had any sex, any experience, and his first form of sex education is hardcore violent porn. Imagine what that does to him. Imagine the self-loathing he feels because the pornography industry say, we know you like this. This is what you want. This is not what he wants. He's obviously interested sexually. There's not good sex education in the schools, which is a real problem. And so he goes to porn. And what they do is they lay a trap, much like a spider lays a trap for a fly. They bring him in slowly through the free porn videos, which is what all the kids are looking at. And eventually what we found through studies is that the more porn they watch and the earlier they watch it, the more likely they are to become habituated to it, the more likely they are to construct their identities around the violent masculinity that they're seeing, the more likely they are to hate women, the more likely they are to aggress against women. These are studies that we have from 30 years.
But it sounds like you're saying, are you claiming that the pornography industry is deliberately targeting young people?
Well, let me put it this way.
That sounds like what you're saying.
I study the porn industry as well and their business model. So who's going to go to free porn? Those without a credit card who've got no money. Kids. So really, free porn is like me standing outside a middle school handing out free cigarettes every day, after day. After day, or me knocking on people's homes and say, excuse me, do you have somebody under 18 here? Would you please give them this glass, this bottle of beer, and I'll be back tomorrow. The porn industry is the only industry in the world that is above ground, multi-billion dollar and completely unregulated, and actually hands out their products to kids in their most intimate places of their bedrooms and their homes. So do I think this was set? I cannot imagine, knowing what I know about the porn industry and how smart they are. These are very, very smart businessmen, that they didn't get the fact that when they were developing the free porn sites, and they helped develop the cell phone, by the way, they put a lot of R&D money into the cell phone, that they were joining the dots, that of course this would be a way to get kids to porn. And like any predatory industry, alcohol or tobacco, the younger you get them, the more likely you have them for life. So do I have absolute empirical evidence of a pornographer saying we did this to get children? No. But given and what you know about how industries work, it would be unthinkable for them not to realize that this was a great way to get to kids.
Okay, so that is a line of questioning which we could spend an hour on, because I think that there are many people listening would, even though I share your deep concern about young people having access to this very explicit imagery and videos, I think it's another thing entirely to insinuate, as you have, that the industry is deliberately trying to target young people.
Okay, so when you follow the industry and the way in which they use their lobbying arm, the Free Speech Coalition, when you look at the laws they're trying to change, you realize this is, a very smart industry with a very well-oiled PR machine. So I have actually, and it does seem ridiculous. Why would the porn industry? But when it's like anyone who studies an industry, you get to know the ins and outs of how they work. So this is coming from years and years of research of how the industry developed the internet. Remember, it wasn't just just the internet that developed porn. What happened is the porn industry put a ton of R&D money into the internet because they knew that the more affordable, the more anonymous and more accessible pornography was, the more they would drive demand and increase profits. So this is, you know, think of the porn industry as you think of any Fortune 500 company. And by the way, that's a quote directly from the porn industry. Hmm. We are like any Fortune 500 company. So you don't leave this amount of money to chance. You have very sophisticated business plans. That's why they're worth so much money. That's why they're so successful.
So let's talk more about the effect that access to this imagery may be having on young people. Because the concern that brought us to having this conversation today is that because the age of the first cell phone or a first smartphone gets ever younger year after year, that means that the potential for young children to see this imagery seems to be going up. So what do we know about the effects that this might have? What do we know?
Okay, so we have over 30 years of empirical research in peer-reviewed journals coming from psychology, media studies, sociology, and increasingly now neuroscience, which is very interesting when they map the brain of young boys who are using porn. What we know is that the more you and earlier you get to porn, the more you lose capacity for intimacy, the more you develop your sexual scripts around pornography, the less interested in sex with another human being you become, and the more interested in using porn. So you kind of really withdraw from a sexual experience with real human beings, because porn is such a hit to the body. It's such a thud. And in fact, studies have found, when they've actually measured the dopamine receptors, is that when you watch porn, it releases more dopamine than heroin, than cocaine, and is on the same level as methamphetamine. So imagine that hit to a 12-year-old boy, okay, because it's the actual sex and violence together that causes such a dopamine hit.
But haven't people been saying this for as long as porn has been around? That I know that the exact same arguments were made with, like, for example, Hustler magazine, saying Hustler was at a level beyond Playboy, and 12-year-old boys who had Hustler magazine hiding in their bedrooms were having the same effect. And yet the sky didn't fall.
Well, let's talk about, how did you get hold of a Hustler at 12? You got your father's Hustler or Playboy or your brother's Hustler. And how many really could you pinch? They would see it. It's clear, you know, there was maybe every so often you could go and get, you couldn't get on a bus and go to a pawn shop because you weren't allowed in because you were 12. Think about that. And this sort of sporadic entry into the world of women with no clothes on compared to a daily entry into the world of hardcore porn for free. The porn now that is mainstream on Pornhub, which is where most kids go, or through most of the free porn sites, is actually what used to be considered the far end of hardcore porn. And if you wanted it, you had to go to a porn shop where you knew somebody who would deliver that level of hardcore porn.
So really, what we want to talk about for the remainder of this hour is how to talk to kids about it. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how to talk to your kids at ever younger ages about what they might be seeing on their cell phones or their smartphones, specifically regarding pornography. And of course, because this is a conversation about pornography and young people, just want to let everyone know that it may not be appropriate for all audiences, for all listeners, but for adults and caregivers and teachers and parents and family members who can listen, we encourage you to do so. What's on your kids' phones and what are they learning at school and how do you talk to them about it? And really, how do we, in the internet age, in the digital age, with adult content saturating all of our lives, how do we encourage healthy ideas and concepts of relationships and intimacy and consent and sexuality? Gail Dines is with us. She's president and CEO of Culture Reframed, a nonprofit that provides training and education to teachers and parents on how to navigate our sexually saturated media culture. And Gail, we've got a lot of callers, so let me just go to at least a couple of them here. Renee is calling from Portland, Oregon. Renee, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I have been fighting porn getting to my daughter for 10 years. She's 17 now. And I went to the public schools and said, how do you protect my kid from porn? Because I could see this coming. I could see, as a woman, how porn was infiltrating our entire culture. Not only my daughter, but me and my family and my husband and me. I mean, I could see how the internet was just popping porn up on my computer screen every time, and I'd see that my husband would be getting addicted to it. I mean, this was 10, 20 years ago. And then when we had our daughter, I would say, you know, how can we protect her from this? I would go to the public schools. I would talk to my husband about it. And, you know, eventually my husband cheated on me because, you know, he's addicted to porn. And most, you know, women are getting addicted to porn now because it's just everywhere. Every TV show has been pornified. And so, you know, it's just everywhere. And as a woman, I feel assaulted by it. And I could see this coming 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And thank you, Gail Dines, for talking about it from a feminist point of view. As a woman and a feminist, I am appalled by it, and I want it to stop. And thank you, Gail Dines, for
Renee,
Reframed and other sources.
Yeah, Renee, thank you for your call. And let me just allow Gail to respond here briefly.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry, Renee, what happened to you with your husband. I hear that story all the time, and that it does go to ending up cheating and blows up the family. There's no question about that. Let me say, one of the things that we did at Culture Reframed is we asked the same question that you did. How can we help kids stop getting to porn? And what we found when we started researching this is that the most important factor in building healthy kids are skilled, knowledgeable parents. So what we did at Culture Reframed is we built the first ever online program built by adolescent psychologists, parent educators, sexual health experts. You can go in for 5 minutes, 5 hours, it's free, and it teaches parents how to build porn-resilient and resistant kids. So what we do, it's basically like a course with lots of embedded videos, because the problem with this is that we have a public health crisis that is stealth. We have parents, teachers, educators. I gave a keynote address at the American Academy of Pediatrics, 15,000 pediatricians. Most of them didn't even know this. The very people who have been charged with taking care of children have basically been derelict in their duty. So what we want to do at Culture Reframed is to shift that, to build knowledge in adults so that they can help their kids become porn resilient and resistant. Porn is not going away tomorrow. We're not going to get rid of it. So what do we have to do? When I went to school, for example, smoking, everyone was smoking. It was cool. Then it became a public health issue. When my son went to school, smoking was completely uncool. We want to make porn uncool. Mm. We want to make it that even though it says there, it's not the thing you go to. And
Gail,
the way you do that is through parents.
Yeah, so Gail, just for a second here, I have to say, perhaps I'm responding as a parent, but to hear you say that people are being derelict in their duty,
Yes. That
doesn't seem to be very fair. I mean, parenting in any age, but especially this age, is extremely difficult. No parent is just throwing a phone at their kid and saying, have at it. There's no dereliction of duty there.
I'm talking more about the official bodies, like the American Academy of Pediatrics, like education, like the CDC, all those organizations. I understand parenting is the most difficult and humbling experience that one ever comes across. And actually, you cannot expect every parent. We're certainly helping educate parents for our free online program. But what I want to know is, why has there been no comment or white paper or policy from the American Academy of Pediatrics? Where are all the teaching organisations? Where are all the nursing organisations? Where are those whose job it is to build up healthy children? So I certainly would never bash parents because they've got enough on their plate. So you're right.
But maybe it's because in the United States we have a big problem in talking about sexuality to begin with, you know, let alone in schools. Only 24 states have required sex ed. I think culturally there's a challenge to begin with in even just broaching the subject.
Totally.
But Gail, hang on here for a second, because I do want to introduce another voice into this conversation briefly to get a sense of what she's seeing on the ground. Heidi Olson joins us now. She's with us from Kansas City, Missouri. She's a pediatric nurse and a sexual assault nurse examiner, program manager of the sexual assault examiner department at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City. So Heidi Olson, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, given the work that you do, Heidi, how much of this conversation is resonating with you?
All of it. I absolutely am seeing the effects of children being exposed to pornography frequently at my job. And I think it's this is maybe the extreme side of children viewing pornography, but we are seeing just an alarming number of children who are committing sexual assaults on other children. And then we also have just gotten a lot of disclosures over the last few years from victims and from families that pornography was a factor in why the perpetrator acted out. It may not be the only factor, but it's almost like pouring gasoline on a fire. If a child already has trauma or attachment disorders, and then they're repeatedly exposed to violent pornography, suddenly they are acting out more and more, and we're seeing just this really horrific trend of child-on-child sexual assault.
Wow. Okay. So Heidi, though, I mean, just to be clear, you're not saying that it's causative, though, but that it's an increasing factor in these cases that you're seeing.
Correct. So we can't say, you know, for sure if a child views pornography, then they're definitely going to commit a sexual assault. Like, that's not true. There are lots of kids who see pornography and they don't sexually act out. But we are seeing kids. We know kids imitate what they see, and we know sexual assault is a learned behavior. So either kids who commit assault have been sexually abused themselves, or they have observed some type of sexual violence. So maybe they already have their own trauma history, yes, and then we add porn in, and it's like just this explosion of hurt for everyone involved.
Mm-hmm. So Heidi, I mean, what advice, what would you share with parents and family members who are listening right now?
So I can imagine for any parent who's experienced this is your worst nightmare, because oftentimes we see kids who have committed a sexual assault, say an 11 or a 12-year-old, they are assaulting a sibling or a relative because it's someone that they have access to. And so just as a parent, I guess I would want to say, I'm so sorry if this has happened, because I can't imagine what that would feel like to have one child who has hurt the other child and you love both of them and want to support both of them. And so I guess my best advice for parents, if this has happened, or if you are concerned about your child sexually acting out in a harmful way, they need therapy. There is specific therapy for kids who are addicted to pornography, who are sexually acting out in harmful ways. And it actually has been shown to be really, really helpful and help them learn healthy sexual boundaries. So I don't necessarily think every kid who commits a sexual assault should be thrown into the criminal justice system. I think that they should get therapy and learn about healthy sexuality.
Right. But Heidi, you're working in a world where patients are coming to you because they have been victims of sexual assault. I'd like to get a sense as to how reflective is that of the broader culture, right? Because you're dealing with, if I can put it this way, I don't know if this is the right way to put it, but like sort of the worst of the worst cases.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to this personally, of course, I'm moved and alarmed without a doubt by what you're saying. But how reflective is it of, you know, what a pediatrician might be seeing in her or his office on a daily basis?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's hard to know, like, if this trend is translating to the rest of the United States, because I don't think other medical places are collecting this data. I think this connection that we're starting to see and hear disclosures about is new, and I don't know, as far as I know, we haven't heard from any other medical entities that are collecting, that are specifically asking questions about pornography, that are noting when it's involved in an assault. So it's hard to know if it's connected, but I do know that child-on-child sexual assault is a huge concern and has risen. I recently read a publication from the Department of Defense where they were investigating child-on-child sexual assault on military bases, and they had heard of a few examples of this happening, but what they uncovered were over 600 cases of child-on-child sexual assault. Mm. And so I don't believe this trend is just happening here in Kansas City, but we just don't have the data to know if it's happening everywhere else.
Well, Heidi Olson, pediatric nurse and a sexual assault nurse examiner in Kansas City, thank you so much for joining us, Heidi.
Thank you for having me.
Gail Dines, I just want to get a brief response from you on what you heard Heidi say.
Well, you know, as someone who lectures across the country, also across the world, often to middle school, high school, and then I was a college professor for 30 years, stories I heard, story after story after story, that what Heidi is talking about. Now, Heidi's stuff is extreme because the average age of the victim that Heidi's talking about that they're seeing is 4 to 8 years of age. Mm-hmm. What I was seeing, and this is increasing when I speak to middle school, high school and college students, is the girls just tell stories like they are exhausted with what's going on. They have been raped. They have been sexually assaulted in so many ways. They can't walk down the corridors in schools without guys coming at them. I mean, and I say to them, has anyone ever helped you navigate your way through this porn culture? And what they say, whether I'm in California, Australia, whatever, they say, no, and we are exhausted. We don't know what to do because this is an experimental generation. We have never before brought up a generation of kids where the boys have access to hardcore porn and are using that as their first form of sex ed.
You keep talking about boys, but the girls are exposed to this too. And is it changing their attitudes of what their desires should be?
Well, yes. What's happening, what we're finding in the studies and also through anecdotal work is that girls use porn a lot less, okay? They're certainly not going onto the porn sites like the boys are. And then when you look at why girls are going onto the porn sites, what we find is mainly two groups. One group where they're actually looking to see what's happening so that when they hook up with boys, they can do what they've seen in the porn because this is what the guys want. And then a second but smaller group are girls who've been sexually abused as kids and want to see the sexual violence in order to... I've had young women say to me, I cannot get aroused unless I see another woman being brutalized. And that, if you know how trauma works, makes a lot of sense. Now, the problem with the research is that most of the research is done on boys. We don't know what actually girls are doing on websites. We don't know how long they're on, which ones they're on, what they're doing on them, and why they're going on. Whereas for boys, we've got a lot more data.
Well, I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Bryant Paul joins us now from Philadelphia. He's professor of media psychology at Indiana University in Bloomington, and his research focuses on sex in the media and the social and psychological effects of pornography. He was co-producer of the documentary and Netflix series Hot Girls Wanted. He provided the background research for those projects. So, Bryant Paul, welcome to you.
Thanks so much.
Do you share Gail Dines' alarm about the exposure to children's exposure to pornography?
I do have a level of alarm. I don't have the same degree of alarm, I would have to say. I think we can agree that there's merit in making sure that kids are exposed to online sexually explicit content as little as possible, and that there are certainly important potential harms associated with such exposure, without overstating or exaggerating what the science says about the nature of effects of such content or cherry-picking only those research findings that support an anti-porn agenda or by ignoring findings which may undermine such an agenda. It's certainly a problem. I am definitely concerned about it, but we don't need to be over-exaggerating or using over-inflammatory language. I think the notion of, for instance, calling it a public health crisis, that's something that has happened in recent years and has gotten it more attention on the public docket than calling it a First Amendment issue. And so it's an issue of, again, reframing how we're talking about it.
But Bryant Paul, so then tell us what you see the science as saying, given that, I mean, you're author of the forthcoming book, The Dopamine Dilemma, and
right.
Gail was talking about how I mean, we know this to be true for cell phones, for smartphones,
exactly.
Period, regardless of the content they're flashing at us, that it does have effects on the brain, especially young, developing brains. So what does the science tell us when you overlap that fundamental truth about cell phones with the content of pornography?
Right. So there's certainly evidence that exposure to online sexually explicit content can negatively influence the attitudes, beliefs, behaviors of at least some young people. And these impacts are not, however, as clear cut or direct as some might assume. There's a couple of reasons for that. One, not all porn is created equal. We have a content analysis study that is under review currently that talks about with an academic journal and finds that actually, depending on the genre of content that you're talking about, there are different levels of aggression and violence. And it also depends on how you are defining aggression and violence. Gail often cites this 90% statistic. We found that the number of scenes or the percentage of scenes that were roughly depicted violence and aggression in the most popular content ranged from about 33 to 36%. That was actually a study that came out before ours that found a similar number. That 90% number is particularly high. But what we do find is that one of the issues is parental mediation is the absolute key here.
Right.
And that is that, yeah, you know, given exposure to this type of content in a vacuum, bad things can certainly happen. Doesn't mean that they will. But the one thing that we have seen over and over again that can help in this process and avoid these potential negative outcomes is parental involvement, talking to kids. Talking to your kids, talking to any kids that'll listen,
right.
Having that conversation.
Well, so when we come back from a quick break, we will discuss that, because that's really what I want to get to in the course of this hour. So Bryant Paul and Gail Dines, I know you have some responses to what Bryant's saying, but hang on here for just a second. We are talking about what to do in a world where children at ever younger ages, because of those smartphones and those devices, are being exposed to pornographic content. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how to talk to your kids about the adult content they may be seeing, the pornography they may be seeing on their smartphones as kids at ever younger ages are given access to these devices. And of course, given what we're talking about, I just want to remind everyone that this conversation might not be appropriate for all listeners. But we're joined today by Bryant Paul. He's professor of media psychology at Indiana University in Bloomington. And Gail Dines is also with us. She's president and CEO of Culture Reframed. And Gail, I know you had a quick response to some of the things Bryant was saying, but I also want to get to some callers. But Gail, go ahead.
Yeah. I just want to say that I wish I was cherry picking the studies. Nobody more than me wants to be proven wrong. Sadly, when you go with the weight of the evidence, which is what you do in social science, and now we have well over 30 years, the weight of the evidence is showing, of course, not every boy who looks at porn is going to rape. But what we're seeing is massive behavioural and attitudinal changes. And so you can take a study that shows, no, that's not true. But that's not how you make assumptions and generalisations about the research. So what we know without question, when you look at the weight of 30 years of research, is that the effects on kids, I am not in any way overstating the argument. I am just merely repeating seeing what the findings are. And I just wish I was wrong, honestly, and that this was not true. Because if I'm right, and if the studies are right, what we are looking at in the future is something we've never seen before, which is, what does it mean to bring up a generation of boys with access to hardcore porn as their major form of sex ed?
Bryant, let me ask you, you know, there are aspects of what Gail is saying that I questioned her about earlier, that this argument has forever been made about pornography. But what about her point that the extreme nature of what kids have easier access to is fundamentally new?
Certainly there is, I think, greater access to more extreme content. That said, that doesn't mean necessarily, first of all, that's all that they're seeing. In fact, what we do see is that in terms of popularity on these sites, on the free sites, the most extreme content tends to be some of the least popular or popularly accessed content. But of course, with new content comes potential new impacts. But I think this goes back once again to the issue becomes talking to your kids about them, getting them prepared to be media literate, what we call porn literate, when they consume this type of content.
Well, let's go to callers, okay? Let's go to Amy, who's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Amy, you're on the air.
Hello. I think my initial questions, a lot of them have been answered, which is just kind of, what do parents do? We have a 14-year-old boy who I think was doing pretty developmentally appropriate things in terms of, you know, going on the computer and looking up things like sexy girls or, you know, breasts, and then would suddenly come to unbelievably extreme sites like Pornhub, and then just got confused, you know, and we got confused as parents, because here he's entering sexuality. You don't want to shame them about sexuality, but you want to be able to say, you know, we had lots of discussions around some of this is not real sex, some of this is really dangerous, some of this is really violent. But it just kept happening repeatedly, to the point where we had to spend hours, you know, blocking everything on our phone, taking all devices away. We're lucky we have a really great therapist. But I think we're at a point now where it's like, what do you offer? Let's just say your kids really do. I mean, I know in an ideal world, they wouldn't maybe look at porn at all. But let's just say, I mean, I think lots of people do. So what do you offer them in this day and age? I mean, we're having lots of conversations, and hopefully, you know, no harm has been done from what he thought up until the point we found it. But I think lots of parents, I mean, it sounds like Culture Reframed is a great organization.
Well, so Amy, let me just take it back from you from there, because your question about what do you offer, I want to get Gail Dines briefly to respond to that. How do parents engage in when their children have already been exposed to this stuff?
Well, first of all, and again, sorry, Amy, that your son was exposed to such mainstream hardcore porn. They have to find a good therapist. Sadly, there's not many. You have to be really careful who you find, because a lot of these therapists make it worse, not better, because they themselves don't know the literature or the research. And we found that in a number of cases. One of the things that I think is really important is that parents should not be left alone with this. The schools need to be acting. Why is there not good sex ed in the schools? Because Amy asked, what do you know, show the kids, what's the alternative? That's a really good question. These kids are sexually interested. They should be able to see sex as something fun, creative, that they're the author of. And at the very same time, we're talking about abstinence only, which is absolutely ludicrous and the biggest gift you can give to the porn industry. So I would like to see really well-trained teachers doing really robust sex education that isn't just about scaring kids about all the STDs you're going to get, but giving them a vision of what sex could be like if you become the author and the architect of your own sexuality and not a bunch of predatory capitalists in LA producing pornography.
So, Bryant Paul, let me ask you, I at this point in time, I suppose, again, as a parent, I am hungering for some real practical advice here. Like, if you have a 10 or 11-year-old who has encountered this content on their phone, what do you do as a parent? How do you have that conversation? What do you say?
Right. Well, one of the first things I think to think about is that it's not too late when that happens, when the 9 or 10-year-old is exposed to that type of content. But I think there's a teacher at a school in Philadelphia, actually, Al Vernacchio, who wrote a book for Goodness Sex, and he's talked about this on sex education and issues. And his point is that we have to couch this entire conversation in the larger conversation of respect for other people, in understanding, again, media literacy, the notion of correct behaviors. And so the idea is that this needs to be a larger conversation. The best way of potentially buffering against the potential negative effects of this type of content is to have that conversation started even before they are ever exposed. And so there are books. There's a book called Good Pictures, Bad Pictures that is a read-aloud book. They have two different versions. One is for 3 to 6-year-olds. The other one is for slightly older kids. And the idea is that you sort of take them through this process, and you don't cover it as something that's vicious and scary necessarily, but you start it as a conversation that then has to continue throughout their entire lifespan.
Can I add also that on the Culture Reframe website, part of our parents program is we actually tell you how to lay the groundwork to start the conversation. Mm-hmm. For example, we say with boys, do it in the car so you're not face to face. And then we have 12 scripted out conversations about what to talk, how to talk about pornography, bodily integrity, consent, bodily boundaries. And we got them scripted out by a professional parent educator. And each conversation, because we realised, remember, your kid would rather be anywhere else in the world than talking to you about pornography. So we assume it's not going to always go so well. So each conversation comes with a second one to say, if it's not going too well, this is a way to bring it back. So I do encourage people to go onto the Culture Reframe website. That's absolutely, what can you do? Those conversations were scripted. And why were they scripted out? Because originally we were going to bullet them out. And when I said to parents, we're bulleting them out and then we're going live, they all jumped up and said, no bullet points, script them out. Tell us what to say word for word. Yeah. So we had to rewrite them.
Well, I want to actually get to a lot of callers here. So let's go through a bunch of people here. Luke is calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Luke, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm a high school and middle school teacher. And I have to say, I was calling about something else, but as I've listened, it's feeling more and more, and I know I'm going to get backlash here, but a bit like that, this campaign in the 90s against hardcore hip-hop and rap. I get that this is horrible, but we have to have open dialogue with kids. If we come in with guns blazing about health crisis, there's no good therapists, we're all, you know, this is all going to ruin, these kids are not going to respond, nor are the parents. Like, I don't know. I find that I make headway with my students when I talk with them, explain what's out there, explain that this is not realistic, that it's just like a movie, that it's a fake portrayal. You know, I don't know. I just feel that there's an intensity to some of these guests that you're having today that I'm finding a little hard to handle.
Right.
Well,
so Luke, I think you're referring to Gail, and I'll get Gail to respond here in just a second. But Luke, thank you for your call. But on that point, let's go to Jen, who's calling from Binghamton, New York. Jen, you're on the air.
Hi. I think the first point that I want to make is that there are a lot of issues with sex education. There's no standard for what is to be talked about in sex education, and it varies a lot from state to state. The second point is that porn is not going away, and I think it's important to mention that when porn is done right, it can be so powerful. I mean, what parent wants to sit down and talk to their kid about what specific kinks are okay? And the biggest issue in the porn industry is that porn is a very male-controlled industry, and a lot of performers, they don't own their own content. They're not getting to decide what type of content or what direction they want it to go in. So the best thing that you can do is, first of all, stop supporting the bigger porn companies like Braziers who have had sexual abuse mm-hmm. allegations, and support the performers. There is a movement in porn to have more realistic and more appropriate yeah. content that discusses consent. And so the best thing you can do is, first of all, start paying for your porn and support the smaller artists who do have control over what content they have.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for your call. So a couple quick thoughts there. Gail, first of all, I just want to get you to respond to what our caller Luke was saying, that he believes the alarmism that he hears in your message is actually making it harder for people to talk with their kids about it.
Well, you certainly don't do that to kids. You don't go in with guns blazing, and I think you definitely do not go in shaming or blaming the kids. I'm talking to parents here now, and one of the things that, especially we say in Culture Reframed, is we even have a model called Compose Yourself, where you do not go in you know, shouting, screaming, yelling or whatever. You've got to really think in a sort of mindful way how you're going to have this in a way where you become a partner and a parent to your kid around this. So I completely agree with Luke. The other thing about the notion that there's women out there creating alternative porn, first of all, that's a bit of a myth. There's not that much out there. And secondly, you know, when we're talking about kids, what 12-year-old boy who puts porn into Google is really going to look around for so-called women-produced porn that he's going to have to pay for? I mean, he's going to land on Pornhub, which is where most of them land. Pornhub gets more visitors than Netflix, Amazon and Twitter combined each month. So this is where they go. So look, we can have all the discussions we like about good porn, bad porn. But you know what? We'll do that after we have stopped our kids going and learning about porn and sex from hardcore porn.
Bryant Paul, let me turn back to you here for a second, because I wonder, how do we understand, how do we talk to our kids, not just about the fact that so much of what you see in hardcore pornography is totally unrealistic, but about this deeper notion of what is normal, what do constitute healthy relationships? How do you have a conversation around consent in moments of intimacy? I mean, I think we should give credit to young people that some of the stuff they see, they probably will get that that's not real. But the underlying messages of what constitutes healthy relationships, how do we have those conversations?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, one of the things I just want to go back to real quick is just this notion that, I mean, we definitely don't want to shame kids, but we also really don't want to, as to the earlier caller's point, we really can't be shaming parents. We can't be shaming educators. And I think most people are acting in good faith, right, in trying to do the best that they can for their kids and for other people. Maybe not you might not buy that the industry is interested in doing what's best for children or their customers necessarily. These are tough conversations to have. These are hard discussions to start for a lot of people. But if you don't talk to your kids about it, there is a very good chance that the porn industry or other kids, their social media feeds and a myriad of other sources will talk to them about it instead. And so it's best to have control of this message, I think, by starting the conversation at a young age, making sure to continue it as they develop. And there is no one-size-fits-all approach to talking to your kids about this. That's the thing, is I've had a lot of parents that'll, you know, they'll say, well, I started talking to my child about a pornography. Well, how old was your child? 11. And they said they had never seen anything. Well, you might have planted a seed that made them think, well, maybe I should go check this out.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you there, Brian,
no,
but
please.
I do want to just see if we can sneak in at least one or two little calls here, because this has really touched a nerve with a lot of people. So Buck is calling from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Buck, you're on the air, but if you can make it fast, I'd appreciate it. Go ahead, Buck.
So I just wanted to add a comment. I've been a very progressive sexual education teacher at Swampscott High School in Swampscott, Mass. for the last 23 years. And I've had the unique opportunity of having a almost total curricular freedom. But I just want to chime in to say that I think that what's being talked about today is really, really important. And over the 23 years, I've also tracked boys and girls' perspective on themselves and on each other based upon exposure to porn as porn came alive with the internet. And it's really distressing. And I want to add one resource, and there's a wonderful book called The Talk by Dr. Sharon Maxwell, which is about how to talk to your children about sex in a media-saturated, overly sexualized culture. It's a wonderful resource. Mm.
So you're seeing that things have changed in the young people you've worked with, Buck?
Oh, absolutely. And not for the good. I mean, it's just the boys' sense of entitlement for what they deserve, the lack of consent, the lack of respect. Yeah. The girls' self-esteem has just gone to the toilet. One really interesting exercise I did in class, which was to have kids put answers on a little sticky piece of paper, so it's anonymous, to answer the question, how does porn influence how a girl feels about herself? Another question, how does porn influence how a boy feels about himself? And then we swap it up in terms of how do you feel about the opposite gender. And the consensus, the summary is it's all really negative.
Wow, yeah. Well, Buck, thank you so much for your call. Gail Dines and Bryant Paul, we have just a couple of seconds left here. But Gail, I wanted to give you a chance to have a last thought for today.
Okay, well, there's clearly parents are concerned. And this last call, I'm really glad he's doing this in his school. But this is a new age that we are in. We have to start really acting, parenting up, adulting up, and dealing with stuff we've never dealt with before. That means a especially learning how to talk to your kids about pornography. It means learning how to get it into schools, enforcing that the schools do good sex education, and ultimately along the line saying, why should the porn industry be the only unregulated industry in the world that is allowed to deliver our porn to kids? That's one of the big questions. Well, and please go to cultureReframe.org to see our program.
Bryant, Paul, I've got about 15 seconds, but I was wondering if you wanted to get a last thought in here.
I'll just say that there are definitely resources out there that parents and educators can use to help them start these conversations. I would warn people to be careful in making sure to understand the real agenda of those offering that information, but it seems like it should just be enough that we are simply interested in protecting our kids from potential negative effects and just have that conversation. You've got to start that up and couch the rest of their lives in that overall conversation.
Well, Bryant, Paul, and Gail Dines, thank you both so much for joining us today. Folks, go to onpointradio.org for more information and to leave your comments there. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.